Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush Friday edition. This is a special edition, everyone, because one of your favorite recurring guests, Mr. Dan Bush, filmmaker, is here. Say hello, Dan.
Hello.
And we also have another person in here with Dan, April Billingsley. Say hello.
Hi.
And they are in here together because I know we've talked about it on Dan's previous episodes, but they have a film debuting today.
Today. In
podcast time. We're recording this a couple of weeks out, but your film, The Dark Red, is premiering and is available as of today, March 6th. Before we get going, where can everyone see this, just so everyone knows?
Yeah, absolutely. So it will have just premiered at the Women in Horror Film Festival.
Okay.
In podcast time. That's actually tonight.
Right.
No, that's tomorrow night. Sorry.
All right.
No, but it's in theaters March 6th. You can see it at the Nighthawk in Brooklyn.
Okay.
The Gateway in Columbus. Music Box, which is a terrific theater in Chicago. And here in Atlanta at the Plaza Theater. And it's got a week-long run. So
great.
Unless it just explodes. And then they'll just keep it in the theater and, you know, keep making money. And it's also on
– It happened to Titanic. That movie played forever.
Yeah. Let me see here. It's, you know, all the digital outlets like Apple TV, iTunes, mm-hmm. Google Play, Fandango Now, Amazon, Microsoft Movies, PlayStation, Vimeo on Demand, and Vudu.
All right, so
everywhere.
And yeah. If you don't have any of those, there's probably one dude out there. It's like, is it on Gigabox?
Right. And that's US. So it's going to be released in Europe and in other territories closer to like the 16th.
Okay. All right, great. Well, we're going to talk about The Dark Red more specifically in the second part of this episode. But since many people have not seen that yet, obviously, I figured we'd dive in since we have an actor and a director and writer and editor filmmaker here. Mm-hmm. People love to hear this insider stuff. So April, we'll start with you because Dan has been in here a bunch. What is your background? Where are you from?
I'm from Atlanta.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, born okay. and raised. Grew up in Duluth.
Oh, nice.
Just outside of the city.
Uh-huh. That's where my mom lives.
I went to school at Florida State and then lived in L.A. for a little while.
Uh-huh.
And came back to Atlanta.
Did you study acting? And where did your journey start with acting?
So I think I took my first acting class at about 5 years old.
Wow.
And he called me a little drill sergeant when I was
really?
A kid. Yeah, I was very loud. It's good for the stage. I booked my first paid job when I was 8.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was Pearl in The Scarlet Letter at the 14th Street Playhouse in downtown Atlanta.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Yeah. So and I just kept taking acting classes. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't really do anything professionally after that until I turned, you know, until I was like legal and could –
Right. Drive yourself.
Drive myself. Yep.
What, as an actor, well, I guess when you were a kid, who were some of your early, like early favorite movies, early influences?
Forrest Gump, probably.
Yeah.
And Big Fish.
Big Fish.
Loved those movies.
Yeah.
I don't know.
John August.
Yeah.
He was one of my favorite writers. I don't feel like he's around as much anymore. And Dan, you can say stuff too.
Okay.
You don't have to sit there quietly. Yeah, Big Fish, that was a good one. What about, was acting something that, I mean, obviously you wanted to do it when you were a kid because you were doing it, but did you think you could do that as a career?
Yeah, I thought I could do anything.
That's great.
I had a lot of confidence as a kid, and, uh-huh. you know, and then it slowly gets beat out of you and then you're like, no, hard work works.
Right.
But yeah. The reason I wanted to become an actor, I think just sort of it was always sort of in me is I always felt a little bit trapped by the fact that I was only me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that – and that might sound kind of weird, but
– What, only child or
– No, no, only one person.
Oh, okay.
That I couldn't see – that I couldn't live other lives.
Right.
And I wanted to be able to see life and experience and understand it from other people's perspectives.
Yeah.
And so that's what I get.
When did you
now.
Have that thought? That's a really advanced thought, isn't it, to like
– You know, that's actually my first memory that I have is wondering – is like this realization that I could only be me.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and so I think it became kind of like ingrained in who I am that I really wanted to understand and live other perspectives.
Wow. So you could – there were two paths. You could be an actor or a sociopath.
Sure. We'll go with
that. That's a great answer. I don't think I've ever heard that perspective, but it makes a lot of sense. I bet it scratches that itch of stepping outside of yourself for a bit.
It does and it doesn't because, you know, when you first get into acting, and I think a lot of new actors think of it this way, is it's a way to step outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is once you really understand it, you have to completely accept yourself and embrace all different sides of yourself to really succeed at acting. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword in that way that you don't get to just go live another life. You have to like really live.
Right.
If that makes sense and really experience and accept who you are in order to do that.
We always talked about yourself in a different set of circumstances. So the key is to study the circumstances as opposed to like becoming. I'm just going to become Hamlet and be this, you know, Prince of Denmark or whatever from whatever century, 13th.
Exactly.
Instead, you're like, okay, I just saw my father on the roof. Yeah, his ghost like, telling me to avenge him. What does that mean for me? And if you can internalize that as me, then
– It's like if it was me living in this time, how would I react? It's like people always make fun of, you know, what do they say? The 18th century women who like move their hands funny.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because they had – lots and lots of fabric.
Right.
Right? And they had these very fancy fabric coming off of their wrists. And they it's just a natural way to not – that they would move in order to not get that dirty.
Right.
You know, it's just – everybody's a human.
Yeah.
And you have to embrace your humanity to understand other aspects of humanity.
What kind of training did you do formally?
I've taken acting classes from literally anybody and everybody I possibly could my whole life and studied Meisner. I studied acting in school for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
I studied with at several different places in LA and I'm not really for – I mean I could tell you – I studied the Acting Center. It's one of my favorite places because it was very much an improv-based like imagination technique. Studied with Sarah Mornell here in town. I studied with who Dan also studied with.
Rob Mello,
Meisner here in town. And
talk about Meisner for the uninitiated. What is that method and technique?
So the basis of Meisner is that you're getting rid of worrying about text, of what you have to say.
Okay.
And you're kind of just – so you do a lot of what's called repetition.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not worried about what you're saying. You're just trying to be in the moment and feel what you feel. And it's sort of a door towards exploring how to get to these different states of being.
Okay. Is that when I hear actors say, know the lines so well that you forget about them and then you can just be in the moment? Or is that just more of a nuts and bolts technique?
I think that's more of like wait, are you talking about Meisner being a nuts and bolts technique or the know the lines
so well?
No, like,
knowing your line so well that you can just sort of forget about it.
You know, it's funny because the way that I approach acting is actually not thinking. I don't typically approach acting by knowing my lines so well that I can forget about them. I approach acting by understanding what's behind the lines so well that I don't even barely have to memorize the lines.
Oh, interesting.
Because I understand – because
the why
think about
instead
it,
of the how.
Yeah, because if you think about it, when I'm talking to you right now or when you're talking, you're not thinking about the words you're going to say. You have an intention and then the words come out. And I think in the best acting, it works the same way.
Oh, yeah, sure. What about What is your process like when you get a script? Like, start from the beginning.
So I'll just start with the end goal is to really understand who this person is in between the scenes.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Who they are as a human being, as a full person.
Mm-hmm.
But just starting with a script, like say it was an audition, I kind of pick it apart. Like I start at the beginning and I don't make any assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just try to figure out what are the facts. I think that's a possible common mistake a lot of new actors make is that they get really creative before they figure out what the facts of the script are.
Interesting.
So it's a very creative expressive art form,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't work if you don't honor the script, if
mm-hmm.
you don't honor the truth of the script. So it's like if you have a sister that just died, you don't go, I'm going to pretend that I hate that sister who just died.
Right.
You know, you go, no, that's there for a reason.
Right, right.
And I can't ignore that. So you go, okay, these are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I might take, say I refer to a memory
mm-hmm.
in the script, say my character refers to a memory. Next step after you kind of understand what's happening in the script with all the different characters is to go into your specific character and go, what are my relationship to these different things? Like,
mm-hmm.
if I have a memory, I'm going to take time to, like, actually imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to sit down, close my eyes. And that's the fun part for me is I'm going to make all of that real specific
mm-hmm.
so that then later when I refer to that memory, it's like that you've made this connection in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes more specific without you having to do anything later because you did the work of imagining it.
Yeah. So what about literal – I mean, how much do you make notes and scripts in the margins or is it more internal?
It really depends on the script. But at this point in my process, I'd say it's mostly internal for
mm-hmm.
me.
So knowing who this person is a real human being
mm-hmm.
because what you said really spoke to me as far as that goes. It's a human isn't their – circumstance on any given day. You know, we all have these
yeah.
big, rich lives, and a movie can take place in real time over 2 hours of a person's life.
Yeah.
And that is not who they are. Who they are is what dictates how they react to any given set of circumstances.
Right. And then it's also just to not leave a giant piece out for any actors listening to this is it's about the relationships too.
Mm-hmm.
So a big important thing about acting is that you're always trying to communicate something. You're not ever just – it's rare that you're talking to yourself. And even if you are, it's because you're working through something. But – so knowing how you relate to the different people
mm-hmm.
is very important. We become very different people, you know, talking to somebody who's being very belligerent to us
mm-hmm.
versus talking to our best friend
right,
or
right.
kid, you know.
Yeah.
So
what challenges you the most as an actor? I mean, that could be just industry stuff or what's the toughest part for you,
you know,
in the process?
Actually, so I would say this. I'd say it's the roller coaster of the career.
Right.
It's it's very up and down, and I think it's very important in a lot of creatives probably deal with this, is just this idea of remembering your worth in between the highs.
Right.
Not letting yourself go too low in the lows, not letting yourself get too high in the highs.
Just, right.
I think it's really important to build a life outside of your acting or your work
mm-hmm.
that you're happy in no matter.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. that's great advice for anyone.
I'm glad I heard that today. It's a good reminder.
Well, especially like you said, for anyone in the creative field where you're especially freelancers who go job to job,
mm-hmm.
if you don't get that part, that can't wreck your life.
Right.
For a week.
And I've seen so many people just like go, and I've done it myself. It's like, oh, I suck now. I'm worthless. I didn't get that part. I must, you know, like they really will fall into a depression about that. And
mm-hmm.
the truth, you have to remember, it's like your skill is the same.
Yeah.
You have to have that confidence from within. You can't get it from without. And I think that is definitely the biggest biggest struggle for me, and I know for probably a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think the thing, too, that actors know and have to probably constantly remind themselves, and you as someone who does casting, there are so many things that go into casting a role that have nothing to do with how talented you are or how good your reading was in an audition. Especially when it comes to, like, you know, TV commercials and stuff like that, because they have such specific criteria that they have to check off.
They call it book a look.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I love it when I'm in an audition, a casting session, and somebody comes in and they are so completely compelling within and of themselves, so confident in their own inadequacies and their own flaws, and that's all on display. So that they're just really allowing their vulnerability to come out in such a way that I start to change the way I think about the character that I'm casting.
Oh, interesting.
And
like maybe this person could be right?
Yeah, like maybe my imagination of the character. So like as a director, I would say actors hold the key to unlock the script. Okay. So I know what I want from the script. I think I understand the mechanics, and I have a bird's eye view of like this thing is really about this and these are the directions that we want to go in. But I don't really understand completely until I see the actors. And it's not just these particular actors and their specificity that they're bringing and the choices they've made. It's the relationship between the two. So I put April in the room with an actor of one caliber or one kind of guy or another actor. And then I put her in the room with a different actor or actress. And it's going to change the scene entirely, the way they react. And so the relationship becomes something that unlocks what the script is about, and it becomes personal.
Yeah.
And that's for me, that's the boat that sails, you know?
That's the train
that leaves the station for me to understand what the hell I'm doing. And it's not until I see that. Sometimes I'm really nervous before I show up on set. And as soon as I see them start to work, I'm like, oh, right. This is what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
In acting, we talk about bringing yourself to a role because no one is you, that you have to bring your own uniqueness to it. And to bring it back full circle to me saying, oh, I wanted to understand these other perspectives, but to do that you have to fully embrace yourself, and that's the one thing that it's so important for I think actors, artists to understand, is that no one else is you, and everybody thinks they need to add on or do something extra, and it's like people really, it's kind of like what Dan was saying, they just want to see you, in a lot of ways. It's just do less, just be. I mean, I know that sounds cliche, but it's true.
No.
You're interesting enough without having to try to be interesting. And if you can allow that, you're going to be even more fascinating to watch, you know.
Yeah, something you just said too, I've never directed, but I've written a bunch of scripts. And when you're writing, you're always, you know, and I assume that people write this way like I do, but you're literally playing the movie out in your head, especially when you're rereading. You're visualizing it, how it goes in your head. What percentage of that ends up like that? Or is it like, man, 90% of that is gone and you end up with something else when you're on the day and everyone else is collaborating?
I haven't had the luxury of having such a massive budget that I can
dictate
that I can enforce exactly what I had in my mind. So I have.
But there's something about being open to that though, right? I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it?
What I found is that the limitations make you stronger. So what I found is that the best thing I can do is come up with my plan A, and I shot list and do your thing. I do the previs in my mind, and I imagine every shot in the movie and the mechanics. I know how it's going to be edited, and have a plan. And I go in and I've done that shot list probably two times at least before I go in to the set. But when I get there, like, you know, shit's going to fall apart. It might be raining. We might lose a location.
Right.
If I'm not open, and the actors might come up with something different that I didn't expect. And if I'm not open to what's actually happening in the moment, then I'm going to by striving to get something that I can't necessarily control. Instead, if I can be spontaneous and live and capture what's cool that's happening in this moment, even if it's not what I expected, it's going to make – that's your movie. That's the stuff that's going to make your movie.
Right.
So I try really hard as much as I'm like – because I came from a visual background where I was very much about the cinematography. And then at some point in college, I was like, you know what most directors don't have is an understanding of acting.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, everybody wants to – get all the cool
shots.
So I started acting. I like literally went and did a play just so that I could figure out what the hell, how to even communicate that or what that.
And, were you any good?
I think I was. Yeah,
really?
I was good. I was better on stage than I was in front because I can't just turn it on.
Uh-huh.
But on, if I have a whole, you know, play to work through and live in, but I can't just turn it on and turn it off. I don't know how you guys do it. that's a trigger that I've never been able – that's a craft that I just haven't.
I mean, I have to say that your understanding of acting and taking the time really makes you – in my experience, a really wonderful director to work with. And it makes – as an actor, it's like I really – it allows an actor to really trust you to know that you know that you're not going to – that you're going to do everything in your power to make sure that what we get is the best it can be performance-wise. And that's
– that trust is so key, I
imagine. Yeah, we have to trust each other. So
yeah.
I just got more validation. You give me validation.
I know.
I walked in and I'll give
as far as turning it on and off, man, I don't know.
This is a two-part question, but what is it like for you when you, Dan, how tough is it when you're not getting what you want / really need? And if the actor has a different idea – and I'm sure most of the time it can be great, but sometimes there's got to be situations where you're like, no, that's not the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you handle that with that and still maintain their confidence?
I think the goal – and I've had situations where an actor is going for something or they're not understanding what I'm asking them for, and we've literally had to stop the shoot and go and talk about it because I've had some actors that are so strong-willed and in their craft, and I know what I want.
That's worst case scenario because it's never good to have a shoot grind to a halt, but much less when you're indie filmmaking.
It's the worst goddamn thing in the world.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's literally in the crew's like you're hashing it out with this actor.
I know, man.
While the crew's sitting there picking their noses, and you're like, okay, we're losing. We're not going to make our day.
Yeah, 15 minutes is a big deal.
But at the same time, you have to figure it out, and you have to do it quick. So in the best case scenario, what you're going to do is you're going to have time beforehand to work with the actors so that you both can come to understand the truth. And you do that by questioning each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, well, why are you saying this? What's the point of this? What are you – and you've worked towards a point where you start to figure out what the person wants, what they're trying to do in the scene and why they're trying to accomplish that goal. And so the questions are always, what do you want? What's in your way of getting what you want? Mm-hmm. And what's at stake if you don't get it? Same thing is true of when you're writing. You have to ask the same questions. And, you know, and if at the end of the scene the actor isn't either closer or farther from their goal, the character, I should say, then, you know, then why do you have the scene? What's the point?
Yeah, it's not moving it anyway.
Right. If it's not moving, if you're not fighting for stuff. So I guess the simple answer to that question is you have to come together and both understand the truth of it. And when you do, in fact, I'll say this, when it has been hard and you're misaligned and you don't quite understand each other, when you do come together and have that, when you figure it out, usually there's an aha moment that you both are like, oh, right. Oh.
That's the thing, yeah.
Usually it's a gift that you had that conflict that you weren't understanding each other because it becomes this opportunity to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
It usually leads to a greater harvest.
Right. And perhaps more trust.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's the same with any relationship.
If you can trust that your argument is going to be
fruitful
because it's going to force you to have a better movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And April, on your end as an actor, what is the – and I know it's specific to each person, but what is the wrong way to handle you as a director? What are the wrong moves
that Dan doesn't make? Dan doesn't make any of these. I think we had a very good relationship actually. The wrong move. I just came off a very emotional shoot where I was playing a bipolar character, and I'd say that as far going back to that jumping in and out of it, like how somebody says action can really affect me. If I'm about to do a really like tender, like depressed or a crying scene or something, somebody's like, action.
Right.
And like, I will have to take a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had before somebody do that to me and then me be like, okay, I'm not going to start until I clear that from
right.
my head.
Because it's distracting.
You need a few seconds, you know? I mean, really, at the end of the day, when you're experienced with this, it's really only a few seconds. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes when you wait a few seconds, they're like, okay, whenever you're ready, you're like, it's just, okay, now I need a few more seconds.
Right.
So just, I'd say just that space of like at most 30 seconds mm-hmm. before and after a really emotional scene.
Right.
And being in—
Just having space?
Yeah, but not like space all the time. Just, mm-hmm. just that like— right before and after certain emotional scenes and just having the right like saying action with the right energy, mm-hmm. I think is really oddly important. And,
yeah.
and as an actor, I know that if I get the wrong energy, I'm going to take a moment and make sure that I'm not going to waste everybody's time by doing a bad take and
right.
get into the right energy first. But certainly that has thrown me.
Right.
But generally, I'm kind of like— however you can say it to me, I'd rather have somebody— – I know a lot of actors are like very against line readings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like I'd almost rather a line reading than you not communicate to me what is in your head. If you don't have the words to do that, to tell me
right.
in a way that makes sense, give me the line reading. And then it might take me a couple extra seconds of processing
mm-hmm.
to put it in my actor terms so that I can then act it truthfully
right.
Instead of just mimicking. But I know that that's a lot of people's pet peeve, a lot of actors' pet peeve, and it's not
so.
One of mine.
Interesting.
But, yeah.
I've always tried really hard to and I should repay the compliment because she's a badass.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you hire an actress like April, it's great because – you get past all of the worry and all of the— you can pretty quickly get to process, which
mm-hmm.
is what, and you can roll the you can roll the camera before you call action, and you don't have to cut,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just very fluid because you bring so much to the table and you have so much going on and your energy's so full that all you want to do is just fucking roll the camera, you know?
Right?
So, paying the compliment back.
Oh, thanks.
It's been just an honor to work with you on this thing. You know that. But yeah, I've had experiences with actors where it's, you know, it's delightful and you're in the process and
mm-hmm.
you get to work and you're in like the process of shooting is also the process of
mm-hmm.
discovery and working and you're harvesting these shots and you're not going to use all of them, but you're going to, you know, you're going to find through the process of the takes that you're using, you're going to find what it is that you're doing.
Yeah.
But it's rare that you have an actor that, like April, that can arrive and be present and
mm-hmm.
do the work and be there and be ready, you know, and show up and not be in their trailer or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think people that have never been on film sets and stuff like that maybe have a hard time understanding just how important set culture is
mm-hmm.
and just setting the tone for everyone on that set,
mm-hmm.
every crew member. Like a bad apple can spoil it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A dickhead boom operator
mm-hmm.
can ruin a job. Everyone has to really be— – what were you going to say?
No, there's crew members that I have— – there are certain people that I have worked with before that I won't work with again. And,
right.
when their name comes up, I'm like— – even though they're quite good at what they do, I'm like, I don't want that energy. I need my set to be cool.
Yes.
You know.
I have to say I feel like this last job I did, it was really interesting because there was a really— – beautiful evolution
mm-hmm.
is I was working with a crew that hadn't worked with actors before.
Oh, wow.
And so it went from some of these like, you know, simple things where it was like, I would like to be there for a blocking rehearsal, you know, to them really understanding and really like embracing it. And so I've had a lot of experiences where maybe things, you know, there were challenges here and there. And I think on any set, at times there are going to be times when it gets tense or when
sure.
they're racing against the sun going down, you
mm-hmm.
know, against the clock and everybody's like, you know, wanting it to go really fast. And then you're like, okay, but that's not the space I'm supposed to be in
right.
to make this scene right. And I think it's important for actors, any actors, to know that that's part of what you're there to do is to hold the space.
Yeah. Because for a
yeah.
director as well, I mean, you know how it goes. You're often in the midst of chaos, but you can't be in the midst of chaos And obviously the very—
Unless the scene's supposed to be.
Yeah, like very few mm-hmm. times that would probably help the scene out. But most times you have to protect your actors and your culture. And you as an actor, you got to just stay locked in, I guess.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. Like you've worked with some like A-list actors, like top-notch A-list actors. And, mm-hmm. and you've worked with everybody on the spectrum of like professional to to people that are just noobs or whatever.
Yeah.
Like is there
noobs.
Any – noobs. Are there – is there any like the – is there any – thing you could say about having worked with some of these bigger name actors, and I know you've worked with Tom Cruise, and I know you've worked with these, but is there anything about that experience that differs, like that you were able to walk away and go, oh, that's why those guys are there, or is there any yeah. is there any special sauce or like what?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a well, I think at some of those bigger name actors, Kevin, I had a lot of scenes with Kevin Klein and whatnot.
Oh, that's great. Is he awesome?
He's amazing. All right, he's thank an God. Amazing human being. He is wonderful.
Everyone needed to hear that.
No, truly wonderful. Anyway, yeah, but like seeing like it was especially it was this movie Last Vegas I was on. There was like mm-hmm. five Oscar winners, and
oh,
so
yeah.
I really in this particular circumstance, I felt like I really got to observe how they work, and some of them, Kevin Klein talked to everybody, but some of them, were just very much more reserved mm-hmm. and, stayed on their phone or pretended to be on their phone just
right.
to stay in their space. I realized it was a very different relationship that they had with the director. While mm-hmm. a lot of up-and-coming actors just want to get it right and want to please, mm-hmm. With bigger name actors and especially – like watching Tom Cruise work and whatnot, it's much more of a collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more of them being like, "I'm gonna do," and they're bold. They try things, mm-hmm. Do things, and then it's like the director going, "What do you think about trying this?" It's mm-hmm. much more of like a back and forth and a like a playtime than a "Did I get that right?"
Right,
Oh, that's cool.
And I think that's a big takeaway. Is it like. And one thing I got from, observing these very experienced actors is if you really need something, it's important not to be like a diva or anything like that. But if there is something that's going to make your performance better and it's
sure.
not that hard mm-hmm. to fix, just ask for it.
Yeah, you have to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, so that in certain circumstances, it's like, hey, can we try this?
Right.
And you don't want to do it all the time, but, mm-hmm. In certain circumstances, the whole goal is it's a collaboration. We all want the final product to be as good as possible.
Right.
And bringing ideas to the table as an actor, I think, is very important to being, a step up from just, a day player.
Yeah. I think the most when I used to work on film crews, the best experiences I ever had just as an observer – which you get to do a lot of as a PA and as an art department, obviously, which is kind of one of the coolest parts is you can kind of just be invisible and watch, is actors who were just very aware of what's going on. The biggest problems I saw was when an actor was either had their head up their own ass so much because you could just tell that's how they were as a person.
Right.
Or maybe it was just so absorbed in the role – that it was counterproductive to the what people were trying to get accomplished. And I think that's
yeah.
what you're talking about. Like if you have the time and you know that you can advocate for yourself a little bit, but I'm sure you're also at times like, I know that it's go time and I've got to do my job and really move this thing along as
yeah,
well.
Exactly. It's so important. And I look at it like switches in my head.
Right.
Like – I try to pay a lot of attention mm-hmm. to what the crew is doing. I try to listen in between takes so that I don't need – so you don't have to explain to me something
uh-huh.
that I could have already overheard. I
know right.
that's weird. I end up doing a lot of, I guess, like, just
– Eavesdropping.
Eavesdropping, yeah. But it's like I hear them going, okay, we're putting on a changing lens. Like we're putting it on a 200 and mm-hmm. I know – I know I learned those. So I know even if they're far away that it's probably still a close-up.
Right.
And then and that it's probably a shallow depth of field, meaning you can't move very much.
Right, yeah,
and
yeah.
And to try to be aware of those things so that then you don't do a take where you think it's wide because the camera's far away.
Mm-hmm.
And you blow it and then somebody has to tell you.
Right.
You
know?
I always have this desire to protect. Like I said, I feel like the actor's the key.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's no truth happening with the actors in the scene,
mm-hmm.
then I don't care how beautiful it's lit. I don't care what how crazy gorgeous your lens is.
Mm-hmm.
It's that Cassavetes thing. If it's not real what's happening, then who gives a shit?
Right.
At the end of the day. So I'm always trying to protect – I'm always feeling like the crew – because they're farting and eating donuts and making jokes. And
yeah.
It's like I'm always trying to get everybody just to – just give them some space and be respectful,
mm-hmm.
you know? I don't know.
Yeah. That's why I say it's like switches because – You can't get too much into what's worrying the crew. It's like I just kind of now listen for sort of key things,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, like if they're working out something or I hear somebody say, mm-hmm. oh, you know, she like, oh, somebody fix her makeup or whatever, then mm-hmm. I turn and look for the makeup person. If
right.
the makeup person comes over, I make
that
sure
awareness.
I turn towards the light so that they can
yeah.
see. Like
you sound like a dream
things.
To work with. But those little things make a lot of difference, I think.
Usually any kind of – whether it's an actor being a diva or whether it's a director screaming or whether it's the AD.
Right.
Usually those things – some of them are just ingrained in their personalities and they think that's how they do their job or whatever. But
yeah.
just like in the rest of life, the assholes tend to be the ones who are just insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can figure out what's making them insecure.
Who hurt you?
Yeah.
That's such a beautiful
It's
sentiment.
True. They tend to just true. Be, you know, the guys who are screaming and assholes tend to be scared of something. There's
mm-hmm.
something that they're compensating for, you know.
Well, yeah. We could talk about that too.
I
worked on some TV commercials with Michael Bay. So I've seen the worst of the worst
I've
behaviors
heard.
On set.
Oh, God.
And it's top down. You know, he's a certain way. And that was the most aggressive, toxically male set that I've ever been on in my life, right down to the crew members. And it's not like he goes and looks to hire those people. It's like an infection.
Mm.
You know, it's terrible.
I've
got some stories.
Your energy is attracts your energy. Or
yeah,
whatever.
I guess so.
Yeah, I feel like the director very much sets the tone. And I've been on sets that are wonderful. And been on sets that are horrible at all different levels of budget,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I don't think
– Yeah, it's not necessarily just money.
Yeah, I don't think it's just money. I think it's just because, you know, I've been on some big budget sets that were just a dream. Like, whoa, it can be like this?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing, you know?
I've heard Clint Eastwood sets are – he's legendary for just not allowing chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Or loud voices, and I've worked with people that worked on jobs with him, and he just sets a very familial, calm, very calm atmosphere.
I've heard that.
Yeah, he just can't have it, and he's Clint Eastwood.
You know, often
so you can dictate that.
So I mean, there's times when I won't call cut. I'll just say, okay, reset, go again.
Mm-hmm.
Camera back to one. Everybody back. We're gonna go again. I'll throw a quick. I'll direct in between while we're resetting the
mm-hmm.
camera or whatever. But I won't call cut because. People start working.
Right.
They'll start fucking with the lights again. And I'm
right.
like, all right, we knew this was a scene where the actor is going to be emotional or in it in some way, right? They're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I call cut, I had a scene it was back in October, I was shooting a thing and it was for a TV thing. And it was the actresses had to come in and find there was an aunt who had to find her niece had been murdered in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to like, break apart when she
mm-hmm.
saw that. And so I had a great actress and she did the thing. And then I made the mistake of calling cut and everybody starts working. And she's sitting there like still
right. –
she's a good enough actress that she's able to like – you know, she's cool with cut or whatever. I wasn't. I was like, no, just keep rolling, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't – like she's in it. Film it. I don't care if that edge light isn't perfect.
Right.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing
sure.
that bugs the shit out. That's the only time you'll hear me screaming when I'm –
When actors, when you have,
I get to,
really
I become a dick if they can't understand that, like, don't the light should have been set,
right?
For that, we knew this was an emotional scene.
Mm-hmm.
We should be rolling It's like, it's, you know, you might as well be a wildlife videographer at that
right.
point. Right.
Yeah.
You got to capture the thing.
Yeah.
I've definitely been just like crying like on the floor before and then being like, okay, we're going to go. And I'm like, okay, great. And then it's like, and then like 10 minutes later, I'm like, yeah. so are we going to go or can I like, you know, change my emotional state, you guys?
Right.
Like,
for sure. It's,
yeah.
So, appreciate it.
Well, we need to move on. I got a heart out at 20 minutes, so let's get into the Dark
Red.
Oh, God,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
This is an independent film that you, by hook or crook, filmed over the course of how long?
It was about 3 years.
Okay.
It was from the time we started writing to the time to now has been 5 years.
I mean, so. Talk about those challenges as an actor and as a director, everything from continuity to as an actor – being able, because boy, I mean, you go to some places in this movie that I can't imagine is it's easy to just call up on every other weekend or however it worked out in some cases.
Yeah, we didn't really film it like every other weekend. We filmed it in chunks.
Okay.
So each emotional chunk, each mm-hmm. continuity chunk was in one go.
Okay.
So that
makes sense.
Made it easier
right.
in that way. And then, of course, there were some pickups here and there. But
yeah, we shot basically four blocks in mm-hmm. each. And then after that, there was about three or four pickup weekends where we would get together either for a day and a half and do anything we missed. The strategy was because we had literally no money. Our budget was well below $100,000
mm-hmm.
for this entire thing. Too bad. Sorry. That's what it is.
It's amazing.
But it feels like a bigger movie because we had certain strategies in place. One was to break up the shoot so that we could we could make use of changing scenery and changing seasons mm-hmm. to add production value.
Right.
Also, at one point, our character Sybil goes through a body transformation. Mm-hmm. So we took off about 6 months so that April could actually
A badass.
Become a badass and go from sort of a meek, internal, sort of beaten character to this.
To Sarah Connor.
To Sarah fucking Connor. So we strategized that. Another thing, too, is because we didn't have much money and I knew that certain scenes that I had visualized and that we wanted to do may or may not come off or we mm-hmm. may not be able to pull them off, I planned the therapy sessions, which everything, like half the movie is a flashback.
Right. And sort of the
she's
through line.
The story told. Mm-hmm. So I knew that you're supposed to show and not tell, but I knew that if we couldn't get the thing that we wanted to show, mm-hmm. they could talk about it in the therapy session.
Yeah, that was a pretty – I mean,
so
yeah,
we planned to
smart.
Shoot that later in the movie or later in our process.
Right.
So that if anything we missed, they could cover it.
Yeah.
The actors were good enough to tell you a story.
That's just a nice little trick.
My Dinner with Andre it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, you have to – you know, when the money is not available, you have to be really, really smart mm-hmm. and have a good strategy. You've done this before a few times, so I imagine Dark Red not easy, obviously. It's never mm-hmm. easy, but it sounds like you had a really good plan in place, probably because of past experience.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, at one point we had most of the movie in the can. We had like 90% of it shot. And then another movie came along that that had to happen quickly, so I had to like put it to bed or just shelve it and mm-hmm. then go to this other movie and then come back to it. And that process was pretty crazy for me in my life because that's right about when I was having my first child.
Right.
And so I was in the past 3 years, I say I made two kids and two feature films,
right.
you know. But all this was going on, but like the experience of doing the one, which had a lot of bad producing efforts and sort of uptight, mm-hmm. weird, insecure people and bad energy set. And, mm-hmm. but it had, an A-list actor and it had, and in the end, it all came together in a weird way. But this movie in the meantime, which I was making with my family and my friends here in Atlanta,
right.
was so much more rewarding and so much more enriching and so mm-hmm. much more like the way that you want a movie to go.
Right.
And it just, it's a better movie. And it's just amazing how the one costs so much money.
Yeah.
And it didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one cost no money. And that was the lesson for me. I walked away going, okay, so, do I want to make a huge budget movie if the end result is sort of meaningless because you get your legs hacked out from under you as
right.
a director? Or would I rather go make a movie and, with very little budget and deal with that and work in real circumstances with real actors, you know, not that the other actors were bad or anything. They were great. But just the circumstances you provided for a much more, you know, real enriching and, you know, the reason we're doing this kind of thing. Like, this is – why are we even doing this?
Feeds your soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was just such a night and day experience that has informed me going forward in terms of, like, what kind of projects I'm willing to do. And, and I've turned down a bunch since then.
Yeah.
Just because I'm like, yeah, you guys, you're trying to – do that thing.
Right.
I'm not doing that thing again. So you just tell, you get a sixth sense about it.
Yeah, yeah. April, what about the physicality of this role? Like you said, there's a certain, and we don't want to give away too much, but there's a certain point in the movie where there is a bit of a transformation.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more physicality and just straight up, you know, working with a stunt coordinator and fight scenes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you? Did you have a lot of experience there?
I've always moved well, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I always enjoyed, you know, working out and things like that. So that was, in terms of my experience, it's, you know, everything that you do in acting is always a new experience. But our stunt coordinator, Elizabeth Davidovich, became a very good friend of mine. And
she's great.
Just an incredible human and so patient and so wonderful and teaching me and, you know, helping give me plans that I, you know, could follow to get to where I needed to be. And just that was actually – it was actually really fun.
Yeah.
That part.
I bet.
Yeah. And learning that and whatnot.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. And you and I have talked previously about choreography of stuff like that. This all seemed pretty seamless. Like what were some of the – was there ever a point where you were one or both of you are sort of like, it's dark and are we even going to finish this thing? Or was it always like, nope, we're on the right track. We've got the right people in place. So it's going to happen. If it takes 3 years, it takes 3 years.
I had a weird irresponsible confidence in our ability to pull this off.
You might have to have that.
I was afraid that April might move away or have – or, you know.
I mean, anything can happen.
Get another project or – get her haircut. I mean,
sure.
So a lot of it was me just having faith and hope that she would stay with us the whole time. And
right.
The more we got into it, I think the more you became an owner of the movie and really basically a co-producer in it.
I feel like as a star of a movie, though, you should take some ownership of the movie and like.
But
it's important.
There gets a point when you're spending your own time and your own money on a movie. You're not just getting paid to show up and then leave. Like you had to invest in your life had to invest and you had to make room for this movie for years.
Because life happens. Like anything could have happened in that 3 years that would could have stopped you from shooting this movie.
I don't think we ever went out
I wouldn't have, but.
I don't think we.
Well, sometimes you don't have a choice, you know. Sometimes life throws things at you that you got to.
That could have been true for Dan as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think even if I had booked something huge or whatnot that I would have been like, we're figuring this out.
Yeah.
Right. That's
true. I don't think there was ever a darkness where I was like, okay, it's not going to come together. It was always – this was always the love. Mm-hmm. This was always like, oh, well, let's go back and keep working on The Dark Red because that's cool.
Right.
And that's fun, right? Mm-hmm. So we kept going back. I mean, in fact, there's times when I wish we had some shoots left to do sometimes. I'm like, I wish we could go do a Dark Red shoot right now because that's
– Right.
That's always cool. No, it was always hard as hell, but it was –
You could fake some deleted scenes.
And I think that comes across in the movie, that it's a very enjoyable experience and ride, and that the audience can enjoy our passion that we put into it.
And sure. I was thinking about you, like you really, like this is a cool character. I mean, I like the character because I wrote it, but like I wonder about what it, I mean, there's such a range with this character from all these different things that you had to experience and portray.
Yeah, big time.
You know, on so many levels emotionally.
Yeah, it's my passion.
Yeah, there's tons of passion. There's tons of grief. There's sexuality. There's, you know, there's revenge. There's so much stuff that you had to go through. Was it hard to keep coming back to these things? I know we shot different emotional blocks. Revenge block is different from like the.
Yeah, I think certain sections of it were definitely can always affect you more than others. It's kind of like when we were walking in, I was talking about this project I just did and how it's like, you know, you can't – you do teach yourself as an actor to jump in and out, but also some stuff kind of lingers with you.
Right.
You know, and you, it takes a minute to process and for you to go, well, why am I sad right now? I don't think I should be. Oh, I think it's because this, you know, you this piece of this movie is still in me, this piece of this – character. And you know, any character you play, I think, stays with you in a way. And
do you miss them?
Yes and no, because I played a lot of tortured characters.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's I just saw a thing with Melissa McCarthy where I think they were asking her about her favorite characters. And she really it was a very personal thing you could tell where she was like, I really kind of love them all. And she – and I imagine a lot of actors think of them very much as real, distinct people that exist in a world, you know. That's pretty cool. I love it. Let's talk about independent film and just once your movie is over, what the real challenge starts in a way. It's hard enough to get the thing in the can, but then you want people to see it.
Right.
And talk about distribution on this level and and the challenges and the process.
The classic way is to just start putting – just begin submitting to festivals. And you go into the festival circuit. There are some rules around that. We made a weird – we took a big risk, I should say, when we submitted to the Austin Film Festival, which is a writers-based film festival. But it's a very prestigious film festival, even though it's a small regional festival. And they reached out to me and they had seen the movie and they were just like, we would love to premiere this. And so for that to be our world premiere meant that we were not going to be accepted, like that that would bar us from Sundance.
Right.
But I wanted – my whole thing with this movie was like, let's – instead of like – hanging on to hope or
bird in the hand type of thing.
I was just like, let's go where the love is. Let's just continue to follow the path of like, if people like this movie, let's go towards that as opposed to like struggling to try to get people to like the movie.
Right. Yeah.
And Sundance, you know, it's just impossible to get into Sundance. I mean, it's just, there's so many politics and everything with that. And God bless my friends who are still having a good job of, you know, doing a good job of getting into Sundance, but
it's tough.
It's impossible. And, so we went with Austin, and then we got our first reviews back were really positive and really strong, and so that helps. And if your reviews are positive, then that it's just sort of like it, the energy starts to spread. The biggest thing after that was we submitted to Fright Fest, and Fright Fest is one of the top four genre festivals. Now our movie is horror, but it's
Fright Fest in London.
Yeah,
That's right.
And our movie's horror, but it's really more thriller. I mean, it's a bender, like we
sort
like
of thriller mystery.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's got horror elements, but it's not a horror movie.
Yeah, agreed.
But so Fright Fest, like I submitted it, and literally that day after I had submitted it to Fright Fest, I got a call from Paul at Fright Fest, and he was like, "Yeah, so you're in. We love this movie." And I'm like, "Okay, these guys get it. They love it." And I was like, "But it's." I was so scared. It's like, it's not really a horror movie. How are your fans that love like the big broad strokes horror going to respond to such a subtle movie? But he's like, who cares? Let's bring your movie here to London. We'll have a UK premiere and we'll do it. And
I imagine that was a lot of fun.
So that was our end. We were we got an offer. They do Fright Fest Presents with Signature Entertainment and Signature's international sales and distribution, and they reached out to us, and we cut a deal with them. And it was, you know, it's a really simple deal. It was like, okay, well, you know, the mechanics of it were simple, and they had a good track record. And then they had a relationship with Dark Sky, and Dark Sky here, I believe Dark Sky has done everything from like VHS to so Dark Sky liked the movie as well, and they took it on. So that's why, and they've been great about marketing and.
We got more pretty awesome reviews from Fright Fest.
Reviews have been significantly good. So,
So it's got to feel great.
It helps. It feels good.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's helps. A hug for a filmmaker who's been through a war.
Right.
but it's also, it also means a lot in terms of, I think just the zeitgeist and the energy of your film, but it means a lot in terms of they can literally take quotes from those good reviews and use that to put on the cover of the Red Box.
Yeah.
And sell the movie. So
that's awesome. Well, you guys, I wish we had more time. I have an eye appointment to have to go to. That is the truth of the matter.
Yes, sir.
But Dark Red, as of real time and podcast time, I mean, it is out today, March 6th.
Yep.
In Atlanta, Brooklyn, Columbus. Where else?
Chicago.
Chicago.
Yeah.
And out anywhere you can find it online. It's your best movie yet. And
thanks, man.
April, you're a very, very big part of that, obviously. You were fantastic.
Thank you.
And can't wait to see what's next, always.
Dark Red Part 2. Thanks for having us, man.
Yeah, really, of course.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Go check out Dark Red, everybody. Fun. All right. Thanks, you guys.
All right.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.